Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. June 23rd, 2016 may not be a significant date here in the US, but in the UK, voters had a chance to leave or stay in the European Union. And since then, the British government has been trying to put together a deal to leave the EU, agreements have met record defeats in Parliament, and Prime Minister Theresa May even offered to resign if a deal passed. Coming up, we'll try to come to a deeper understanding of Brexit, listening to a panel discussion moderated by Andy Downs of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics, and recorded at Purdue Fort Wayne. Here's Andy Downs.
Hello and welcome to this panel discussion on Brexit. We have with us today from the Department of Political Science, James Toole, as well as Craig Ortsey, and from the Department of History, Ann Livshiz. I think this is going to be a very interesting conversation brought to you by the Departments of History and Political Science here at PFW. We also want to thank WBOI for capturing the audio and making it available to the public, and of course to College TV for helping us from the beginning on panels like this. We do appreciate their efforts. And I think we should actually start with some very basic information. I know that this may be rudimentary for some folks, but let's start with the basics of what is the European Union. In other words, who are the members?
Well, I'll give the answer that I often give to my class, which is that the European Union is an intergovernmental organization that has 28 member states currently, and they're dedicated to the economic prosperity of their member states and peace among their member states.
And in English, that means?
What that means is that they're interested in making sure that everybody that's a member actually grows economically and doesn't fight one another like, you know, what happened in the first part of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. And how many members are there?
28.
28 members, and that includes the UK at this point.
That includes the UK.
But Russia is not on the list, Anne. Why isn't Russia on the list?
Well, do you want the European perspective or the Russian perspective?
Let's go with Russian first.
The Russian perspective? Yeah. Well, why does Russia need these kinds of institutions that are really just shackles on their members? More seriously, actually that was pretty serious too, but more seriously, I think the history of the creation of the European Union and the timing in which the European Union was really created was not a time that was conducive to Russia becoming a member of an international organization. But I do think, and I think that's something that we're going to have a chance obviously to discuss as we go through the kind of our panel content today, but I think that Craig's kind of perfect definition, with the emphasis on everybody's mutual growth and development and prosperity, also lends itself a little bit to why Russia. This is not necessarily an institution that Russia would feel very that Russia would want to would be a natural fit for. Mm-hmm. Let's say.
Mm-hmm. Now, Craig, you already gave kind of a general definition of what the benefits are, why a country would want to join this, but let's be a little more specific. What are some of the benefits? And then actually I also want to know the cost. Obviously nothing comes with benefits only.
Yeah, very true. A country might want to join the EU to be able to trade without tariff or non-tariff barriers between those countries. And again, in English, what that means is that it should be less expensive for countries to buy products from the other members that are part of the trade bloc. And it should make it easier for them to sell goods to the other members of the trading bloc. The problem is, at least from the UK's perspective, is that they're stuck in a customs union, which again in English means that they have the same external tariff for goods coming from outside the European Union that every other country does. And this means that they can't strike trade deals. They can't get preferential treatment to, let's say, their former colonies, as they otherwise might like to do. And one of the advantages to leaving the European Union from the British perspective is that they would have that power back again.
Mm-hmm. Anne, you had something else?
I just wanted to add one more thing. I think Craig focused on the economic factors, but I want to. But I think there's also kind of a status. I think being a member of the EU is also a status symbol, right? And
very
that's
true.
Why we saw so many former Eastern Bloc countries wanting to join, right? I mean, kind of the ability to join the EU is a marker of normality, right? This is kind of they're grown up now. They're a real European country, mm-hmm. And so there's kind of an important dimension, a status dimension to that. To that as well.
It means they become fully European. That was a quote that was used a lot in the 2000s as these members in Central and Eastern Europe were pursuing membership in the European Union.
Jamie?
Yeah, I think it's important to underscore how truly extraordinary the European Union is. There is nothing like it on the face of the earth. And let me put this into some perspective. First of all, it's an international organization that has some very clear criteria for joining, and this is one very important reason Russia is not a member. To join the EU, you must be a robust democracy in political terms. You must have a robust free market economy, and I know by U.S. by U.S. standards, Europe often isn't seen as being that free market, but in global standards, it absolutely is a very free market part of the world. And third, you need to be able to uphold the obligations of membership, which are very considerable given all the sort of economic complexities that Craig has alluded to. So, and the close integration of these economies is unparalleled anywhere else in the world. There's no group of countries that comes anywhere close to what the EU has managed to accomplish in terms of its economic integration, whether you support that kind of integration or not. And let me say one other thing concerning the very important point Craig made about countries not going to war with one another. You know, the real driving force, formally speaking, in the EU is economic integration, although, yes, the prevention of war, it goes way back to its founding. But really, in so many ways, this organization was founded as a response to World War II, because the idea of European integration had been around for a very long time. But after the horrors of World War II, which came after the horrors of World War I, and other wars going way back in time, mainly pitting France against Germany, but other countries as well, World War II, World War I, the Franco-Prussian War, the Napoleonic Wars, there was this powerful desire to try to just change that cycle completely through the means of economic integration. And I always say that, you know, if you'd stopped somebody on the streets of a European city in early 1946 and said, you know, I think by 1970 it'll be inconceivable that France and Germany could ever go to war, they would think you were a crazy person, but that's actually what happened by 1970, and it's even more true today.
Well, this is another reason why Russia would not be comfortable in joining us, because the origins of the organization are in the Cold War. It was designed to, frankly, keep the Reds out of Western Europe by having greater economic growth and peace between France and Germany in particular. I mean, it's founded on a liberal ideal, and Russia is an illiberal country with the current leadership in charge. And this, as Anne was saying, this is simply not an organization they would be comfortable in joining.
Well, we should, in terms of providing some base. Yes, Anne, sorry.
I do want to say there's a phrase that doesn't come out of my mouth very often in defense of Russia. not so much in defense of Russia, but I think that one of the interesting things is, I mean, both of you have emphasized how important for members of the EU to be robust democracies. And I think that certainly if we look at the member nations, I think that, you know, fingers can be pointed at some of the members whose robustness and democracy-ness is definitely in question. So I think this perhaps is going to be one of the future challenges, right?
No, I agree with that. That the point is that to join, you have to be a robust democracy.
Right.
And those countries that you're thinking of, perhaps Poland, Hungary, et cetera, were absolutely robust democracies when they joined. The problem is that the EU has no effective mechanism of disciplining. It has some mild means of disciplining countries, but no really effective means of disciplining countries, let alone expelling them for non-democratic behavior. So I think you're right, Anne, that that's going to become an increasing issue as some member states become increasingly authoritarian.
So maybe Russia will feel more welcome.
No one ever thought that a country would backslide in the way that Hungary and Poland has backslid in the EU. That's just a fact of life.
Now, we are when people hear Brexit, they often just think England. That's obviously not the case. Jamie, name all the locations that really are affected by this, if you would please.
Well, the first thing to say is England is not a sovereign state. I love England. I love the other parts of the UK as well. But what we're really talking about is not England. We're talking about the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, which comprises four constituent countries, effectively. England is, of course, the biggest, but also Scotland, biggest by population and size, but also Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. So this is the entity, the United Kingdom, that is trying to leave the EU.
And what actually was the question? You know, you think this is such a monumental issue. The question must have been sort of this very elaborate, complicated thing, and yet the question actually was, should the UK remain a member of the European Union or leave the European Union? And the options for people were remain a member, check mark, leave the Union, check mark. That's it.
So there are great virtues in forming a simple question, of course, because that question gives great clarity. So that's wonderful. The problem is that to decide something so unbelievably complex, something that goes to the very root of the constitutional structure of the United Kingdom, is probably something that should not be decided, in my personal opinion, through a simple one-sentence question, let alone through a referendum. And I think we'll probably talk a little bit here about the advantages and disadvantages of making decisions by popular referendum.
And who were the sort of the main players? When this in some respects, it was surprising that it made it onto the ballot, and at the same time, not so surprising that it made it onto the ballot. What were some of the names of the people back in 15 and 16 when this was being suggested? We'll start with Jamie, and then we'll work our way back here. Who are some of the actors in
Well, the first thing I'll say briefly is that the legislation creating the referendum actually designated that two official campaigns would be created, and then there was a process for determining what actual campaigns, these are campaign organizations, would be created. So Vote Leave was the organization officially designated to argue for leaving the union, and Britain Stronger in Europe, which became known as Remain, was in favor of staying in Europe. And who are some of the personalities? I'll mention a few. I'm sure you know others can mention them. I think first we have to talk about David Cameron, who is the British Prime Minister of the day. He was a conservative prime minister. He was the one who led the push for the referendum and effectively created the referendum. He, personally, was for remaining in the European Union. However, his party, the Conservative Party, had long been divided on this issue, and we may talk about that history as well. And so, but Cameron, for various reasons that we could go more into, did not push very hard for Remain. He tried to remain above the fray. He wanted to preserve his status as prime minister, other motivations as well. He was in many ways doing this to save his own political party rather than to sort of make perhaps the best choice for the country. And I guess the other sort of another person I'll mention is Boris Johnson, who later became Foreign Secretary for a time under the current Prime Minister, Theresa May, and he's a larger-than-life figure. He has this very charismatic personality. He has this famously sort of windblown gray hair that goes all over the place. He is a really interesting guy because he is at the same time incredibly well-educated and also very populist. And that combination, many people found very engaging. And Boris Johnson, in the beginning, it wasn't clear what side he would end up on, but he chose the Leave side and campaigned vociferously for leaving the union. And he's still, every week now, he's not in office right now, but he's writing his weekly columns for the Daily Telegraph newspaper, in which he's constantly pushing for as hard, but more or less, as hard a possible leave as hard a leave as possible.
It really is fascinating.
As hard an exit as possible.
That the legislation actually said we will create two bodies.
That's right.
In the United States, we're not used to that. We're if something shows up on the ballot and groups manage to form, so be it. But here, the thought was this is important. There should be groups. There should be organizations there pushing the position, helping to educate the public. That's a foreign concept to us here. Craig, who would you add to the list of important players in the beginning?
Well, I'd add Nigel Farage to that list, the leader in 2015-16 of the UK Independence Party. This is a party that was founded with the sole goal of pushing the UK out of the European Union. And of course, once that happened, Farage said, okay, I'm done, kind of dusted his hands off and walked away from it. He remains, however, a member of the European Parliament. So he has an official spot where you can get up and talk about how awfully the EU is treating the UK throughout this whole process and drawing a salary from the European Union, which he just loathes and despises. So I'm not sure what he spends that money on or whatever, but I'd be interested to know, honestly.
European goods that he won't be able to get if his dream comes true.
And I did want to say one thing about the referendum and the wording of the referendum itself. The referendum was strictly advisory. If David Cameron or anyone who came after him as prime minister had wanted to basically ignore the result of the referendum, they could have. But for various political reasons, they did not.
Yeah, and we'll get to that because it's not even that simple, to be honest. We'll get to that a little later on. Anne, anyone else you want to add to the list?
Can we start talking about the propaganda? Because I do.
Well, I think, Jamie, do you have something you want to add
All
in
I
there?
Wanted to say is that, to throw an American connection here on this, Donald Trump became very enamored of Nigel Farage and maybe the only person in the world who calls him Nige.
Well, let's go ahead and start talking advertising.
So the reason that I wanted us to transition to advertising is that the group that I wanted to mention, kind of if we were looking at the Leave side, so there was the official organization Vote Leave, but there were also other less official bodies funded by not clear who, at least at the time that the campaigns were going about, not clear who. And in particular, kind of I want to draw the comparison between the official Vote Leave campaign and then the Leave EU campaign. And the reason that this that I want to mention this is because, I mean, it's a really interesting example, right, of this kind of very of a very broad campaign. Obviously, both Vote Leave and Leave EU were for leaving. But what's remarkable about these organizations, right, is that allowed the Vote Leave, right, being an official body, it more or less tried to be try to focus on data, maybe wrong data, but it at least tried to keep the xenophobia and the racism to a polite minimum. Mm-hmm. Can we go back to that one?
I was going to say one of the things that a lot of people saw in terms of data was the big bust that had on it. We send the EU £350 million a week, which basically said we're going to get this back if we leave the EU. So you're right. There was a lot of use of data, but the items you wanted to bring up are these.
Right. Well, I just wanted to mention that. I mean, I think that if we're thinking about this campaign and kind of what contributes to this campaign, before we can talk about the official organizations involved, they're tapping into some popular sentiment that certainly started long before 2016 or 2015 or 2014. And so these images that we have behind us from the 1990s illustrate kind of this ambivalence, this longstanding ambivalence in Great Britain about being part of the European the European Union. And in some ways it goes back to, it ties really nicely with Jamie's point, right? If we think about the creation of the EU as a response to World War II and the lessons from World War II, for Britain, the lessons were we like not kind of being apart, but also being apart, right? And so this is a great example of this. And of course, this one, just if you can see it, right, referencing very iconic propaganda from World War I as a way to tap into certain kinds of feelings.
Yeah, and for those on the radio, one of these says, "Wake up, Britain! If you lose the pound, you lose your country." And then the other one is a bulldog that says, "I'm a British bulldog, not a Brussels sprout. Don't let Europe rule Britannia."
Right. I'll let you be the official toucher of the screen. So these two images kind of draw a very nice contrast between, not contrast is the wrong word, the nuance in the difference between the official Vote Leave campaign and then the Leave EU campaign, right? So the one on the right, this is Vote Leave, right, and Take Back Control. So this is the official campaign. Notice, of course, right, and there are many of these. They mention other countries as well. We picked one, right? Turkey, population 76 million, is joining the EU, right? And the message, the message is very clear about why the statistics are mentioned, why Turkey is mentioned, right, what the implications of that are. The one right here, right, is a little less subtle, right? This is, I don't know if you guys can see it behind me, right, Breaking Point, right? I picked these two because when this came out, right, this was seen as going too far, right? This is too much, right? It invoked a lot of the kind of World War II era kind of propaganda that really emphasized dehumanization of and othering of particular people, right? So it tapped into something really, 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 really ugly. In the end of the day, because this was a privately funded campaign, they could do whatever they wanted to do, right? And so having both of these operating at the same time worked out really nicely, right? Because for those people who needed their racism in a polite, sanitized way, they had Vote Leave, right? For those who didn't actually care, they had Leave EU. And so even though the two didn't necessarily coordinate, they really provided sort of a range of options for people, right, as they were thinking about which way they wanted to go. So Vote Leave, right, provided kind of a socially acceptable way of incorporating your xenophobia into your voting practices. And this was just kind of out there to foment a lot of unhappiness and really kind of tap into grievances of people who didn't necessarily think about, well, what does this mean? How do we, but really just focus on the grievances.
There also were much more text-based advertising that was going on, the facts, and then it would list a series of things that obviously were intended to support a particular position on the issue. Anything else you want to add to the propaganda, discussion of the propaganda or the discussion leading in?
I'll just say one or two things. I mean, I think the two really big hot-button issues surrounding the referendum I think, really concerned trade and immigration. And both of them have a lot to do with an even more fundamental issue of sovereignty and whether Britain should be beholden to anyone else or go more alone. And Anna's, of course, already talked about the immigration dimension. Well, I'm sure we'll talk more about the trade dimension as well. I would just say one thing about the images we just saw and this text issued by, I forget who issued this, Vote Leave, Take Control. So this is from Vote Leave. And that is that it was a complete lie that Turkey was about to join the European Union. I mean, Turkey is nowhere close to joining the European Union, has been nowhere close to joining the European Union. No serious observer would ever have said that that was true. And so and this is stated very directly both in the ad and in the text. There's another thing in the text that says the border between the UK and the Republic of Ireland has nothing to do with the EU, and says that there will continue to be a passport-free crossing of that border with no trouble. And we now see, just days before our latest exit deadline, that the border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which is an independent state that is another European Union member, is one of maybe the single biggest issue right now that is preventing an exit.
Yeah. And what's interesting about that, right, is that there are lies, but they're presented in this very innocuous, oh, it's just some data. Here's some data for you, mm-hmm. for you to consider, yeah. right? So you have this kind of data, quote unquote, right, based propaganda campaign, and mm-hmm. then the, you know, migrants are scum propaganda campaign, yep. Nicely kind of dovetailing together to provide this this rating.
Well, and it states as fact several things that would have had to be negotiated in agreements.
That's right.
And that's interesting because there are people throughout this entire process who've said things like, well, this will be easy, mm-hmm. but they have assumed that certain things would get negotiated into an agreement that have not necessarily gotten into an agreement. Craig, any comments about the propaganda?
Yeah, I was going to comment on the propaganda is that this exact same issue came up in the 1970s during the first referendum on whether the UK should remain at that point in the European community. I remember seeing, you know, contrasting, so stay versus leave campaigns where they were trying to decide how expensive goods would be for housewives if the UK stayed in the European community versus them leaving. And of course, each side had it more expensive if the other side won the referendum. And I think that reflects on the kinds of issues that were happening in 1970s Britain about inflation and price increases and that kind of thing. And that was being weaponized by both sides in that debate in the same way that immigration was being weaponized here by Vote Leave.
And what's interesting is there really is not a true answer to what it will cost. Because we don't know, so many of the trade issues
right.
were not resolved, have not been resolved.
Right.
Therefore, we can't know. And we're talking economics, which
right.
is a projection to begin with. So it gets very complicated very quickly, but you can use the data to your advantage.
Yeah, my students get really tired of hearing me say this, but it depends on what happens. We don't actually No, but under no scenario, legitimate scenario that I've seen anyway, the UK definitely loses out. They lose something. The question is how much.
Well, on June 23rd, 2016, there was a vote. And as we all know, the vote was, I'll call it a resounding, 51.9 to 48.1, only because how else do you describe a close election but resounding if you're on one side versus the other? The map you see up on the screen, you'll see that England, a majority voted to leave. Northern Ireland, a majority said stay. Scotland, majority said stay. Wales, a majority said leave. Jamie, let's start with you. What does this tell you about what the people of the UK want?
Right. So it shows that the people of the UK are very closely divided. And we see almost 3 years later that a lot has changed and very little has changed. What has changed is that there's been, you know, unending debate about all sorts of things, general to specific, and people should be at least far better informed. However, public opinion polling suggests that the country is still very closely divided. One thing I would say about this specific result is that the scale of difference really is remarkable. In Scotland, for example, the Remain vote was 62% to 38% for Leave, so it wasn't at all close in Scotland. And in Scotland, it went against, of course, the run of the entire country. And that only deepened the existing divide between Scotland and England in particular. And the other thing I would point out is that although England went for leave, London very strongly went for remaining in the EU, because London is such a cosmopolitan city, because it's such its links to the rest of the Union are so profitable and so meaningful. So even within England, at least with respect to London, there was tremendous variation.
And we should remember Scotland had a vote about leaving the UK too long before this vote.
Mm-hmm. That narrowly failed.
And then when this happened, there was talk of Scotland actually having another vote, depending on how the negotiations for leaving
went. Many Scots have said, you know, look, we almost left the UK because we were dissatisfied with the way we were being told, you know, how to do things, et cetera. And now we've expressed very strongly that we're against leaving. And if the UK leaves, we have even greater incentive to say, forget it. Why should we stay in this country?
Yeah, it's interesting how we talk about, you know, that referendum narrowly failing in Scotland. It was 55-45 no. We talk about this as being resounding, and this was 52-48 to leave. I just think that the language here is being strongly influenced by the side that won.
Yeah.
But what I'll say about this map, though, is that the people who voted to stay are the ones who would be most negatively affected by Brexit. So the people who live right along the border between the Republic and Northern Ireland, people in London, the people in Scotland, they're the ones who would be most negatively affected by the leave. Gibraltar, which isn't—it's just on the map, right there on the bottom—voted 95-5 to stay, to remain in the EU, because they're the ones who are definitely going to be the most negatively affected by this. Because now Spain has no reason to not shut off the border between Gibraltar and the rest of the continent. The EU basically kept Spain in check on that question.
Yes, Anne.
I think the way the question was phrased, what does it tell us about what the people want? I know that the referendum is technically supposed to be what do people want. But I remember when the results, what I would like us to remember is, I think when the results came in, I think there was general shock, right? Mm-hmm. This is not what the results were supposed to be. And I think a lot of people, certainly outside of Great Britain, were shocked. But even in Great Britain, there was a lot of shock. And part of the discourse about the shock was, but we were told that we were going to stay, and so I voted to leave to send a message, to express my protest, right? And so I think kind of this question of why did people vote the way that they did, right? And this idea of kind of a metaphorical message, an expression of a grievance, right? Rather than an actual thing that they thought through that this would be beneficial to them, right? And so this question of who it benefits, I mean, I think for some people in some of the areas, they are much more aware of just how closely how much their livelihood is dependent on the EU. I think for the rest of the country, I think I think it's safe to say that many people voted against their economic self-interest, right? Either because they were just trying to send a message or because other factors like xenophobia and racism ultimately seemed more important to them at the time than anything that may have happened to them specifically.
I mean, Europeans have been doing exactly the same thing in European elections for the last 40 years. They perceive them as being low cost, it's not really going to impact me, so I'm going to protest against the government that's currently in charge. And for the last 40 years, that's basically been a good tactic because it has been in safe hands and stable hands for a long time. A lot of voters came into this election thinking, oh, as Anne was saying, well, I'll just protest. I don't like Cameron, so I know he was remain, so I'll vote leave. And in a close election like this, that was enough to tip it to the leave side.
Jamie?
I would say there was one other really interesting, from my point of view, division within the population, and that has to do with age. Mm-hmm. And so younger the voters, the more likely they were to want to stay within the European Union. And the older the voters were, the more likely they were to want to get out of the Union. And in fact, a lot of families are deeply divided by this, of course, generations within families. And I think a lot of this generational divide, though not all of it, has to do with educational and employment opportunities. Because when you're in the European Union, you know, if you're a young person and you want to travel somewhere else, you can travel easily with no barriers. If you want to study in another country, you can study it in another country without gaining any special permission. You can go and live in another EU country without any special permission. So if you're young, if you're ambitious, if you would like to see the world, and of course, if you have relevant language skills, the closing off of Britain to Europe is just a tremendous obstacle. And so we had young people showing up in demonstrations after the referendum saying, you stole my future from me.
Now, yeah. Craig mentioned this earlier. This was a recommendation. There was no obligation. Was there any requirement on the part of the government to do anything with this, to discuss it, to debate it? They could have simply said thank you very much and moved on.
Correct. They could have said, "Well, that's nice," and then gone on the next day, and you know, with politics as usual. But from a practical perspective, there was no way on earth that they couldn't at least take this into account. And what Theresa May did, as Jamie was talking about earlier, because of internal divisions in her party, she went for the hardest possible negotiated Brexit.
Well, and we'll get there in a second because obviously Cameron was in place to begin with.
Right.
We've jumped over him leaving office, which seems like an important point.
Gone by noon the next day.
Yes. Yes. Gone by noon the next day. He said, "I'm out. I'm gone." Conservative Party in control. Theresa May ended up taking the reins. But, you know, you think about something like this, that I mean, 52-48 is close. Mm-hmm. It is close. This is a major decision. Jamie's already said he doesn't think this is the sort of thing that should be decided by a referendum. Certainly a simple majority referendum shouldn't do it. Why not kick the can down the road? Why not say, now we will study what you have told us you're interested in?
Well, because there's probably 40% of the country that are, and the majority of the people in the Conservative Party who are hardcore leavers of one variety or another. They resent what they see as undue influence on British politics by Brussels bureaucrats. They've been indoctrinated with this for decades now with the Eurosceptical press in the UK, and they just want out. No Conservative prime minister could possibly ignore that. Now, that said, they could have gone for a much softer Brexit, meaning they could have said, "All right, well, we'll leave the structures formally, but we'll still remain close. Economic ties will be part of the customs union. We won't obviously do anything having to do with Schengen or anything like that, but we'll continue to cooperate in the Schengen group." But again, May decided to do exactly the opposite. "I'm going to go for the hardest possible negotiated Brexit."
Jamie, you had something to add?
Yeah, I mean, referenda are just such interesting sort of tools of governing, and I think there are real strengths to them. There's something really appealing about going directly to the people, right, mm-hmm. to make an important decision. But there's so many things that need to be considered. For example, here, the just sheer complexity of this mm-hmm. and the very poor quality of the debate that preceded this whole decision even to launch the referendum campaign in the first place meant that this was going to be, you know, this was going to be troublesome. But there's the second issue, which has to do with whether it's smart, how smart it is to go to the people in the first place. And it always sounds very elitist when you question going to the people, right? But this is worth thinking about, that in Britain, also in the United States, we base our politics overwhelmingly on the idea of representative government, on the idea of indirect democracy, that we, in short, elect people to do the job of governing, and that we as citizens don't participate in making day-to-day decisions on policy, but we delegate people to do it for us, on the understanding that at regular intervals we have the opportunity to vote in a free and fair election and thus replace people we don't like and put in people we do like. And that's the norm in both Britain and the United States. In a way, it's even more the norm in Britain because British government is based on the idea of parliamentary sovereignty, that Parliament is the supreme institution of British politics, even more than, much more than, say, Congress is in the United States, because we have a constitution that says we, the people, constitute this country, so really the citizens are sort of at the core. And then our institutions of representative government have three co-equal branches in the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary. In Britain, Parliament is sovereign. And so going for a referendum is, in a way, even... it can be seen as even more perhaps irresponsible or tricky in Britain because indirect election of members of parliament to parliament is generally seen as the main legitimate way to make decisions.
Parliamentary sovereignty is the reason why the referendum is advisory. I mean, they literally cannot put a mandatory referendum on even on the ballot. It's just mm-hmm. it's just not allowed because of the way the British Constitution is set up.
Anne?
And I think that it's telling, I mean, if we're thinking about kind of the questions of responsibility and irresponsibility, I think it's quite telling that the vast majority of the men involved in advocating for this decision shortly after, the results are this, I'm out of here, right? Mm-hmm. Boris Johnson out very quickly. The vast majority of the kind of the advocates for this now are writing, you know, op-ed pieces in which they talk about what they would have done if mm-hmm. only, right? If what Theresa May should be doing and she isn't, right? With the exception of, you know, Nudge, who is, you know, just drawing a salary from the EU. And I think it's quite telling, right, that you have something of this magnitude that first is delegated, you know, is sent to a referendum, and now the people who made that possible and all the consequences of it, right, have now washed their hands of it. They're off doing something else while this horrific mess, right, is left to be handled. I don't want to take completely responsibility off the people who did mm-hmm. what they did. But I think it is important to note, right, the abrogation of responsibility by politicians and kind of the mess that now needs to be cleaned up by somebody else.
It would have been a very, very different situation if the plan had already been in place and said, okay, British voters, here's our plan
That's
for
right.
leaving the
That's
EU.
Right.
Say yes, say yes or no. Yep. Mm-hmm. They basically bought a pig in a poke.
And we know the, in some respects, the mess, I think Anne just called. The mess got started in many respects with Article 50. And Jamie, what is Article 50?
Article 50 is a portion of the Lisbon Treaty of 2009, which is one of the foundational treaties of the European Union. The European Union does not have a single constitution. There was an effort to create one at one point, but it doesn't have one. Instead, it has a series of treaties that have more or less constitutional status. This is one of them. What's really interesting to note is that not until 2009 did anyone even think of writing in a mechanism for countries to leave the European Union. And in a way, that's a credit to the European Union, that it has been seen as so unbelievably successful, so incredibly beneficial to the members, to its member states and to the people of those member states, that no one really thought for a very long time that there would ever be a need to create a mechanism for a country to voluntarily leave. By 2009, it was decided to do that, but as you can see by the text here, it's unbelievably short and vague.
Yeah, there's more to it than the text that's up on the screen, I will mention, but it is, in some respects, it is vague,
but
at the same time, maybe very clear, because it's so simple. Who knows? Maybe that's the way to describe it. It's so clear, it's simple, it's easy to do then, right?
It's an incredibly complex thing. I'm not sure. Go ahead, Craig. Explain this one.
No, you're talking about harmonizing markets for thousands of goods and services in 28 countries. That's going to be a bureaucratic Gordian knot, and I don't know how you untie that.
It is Monday, April 8th when we are recording this, and I'll be even more specific. It is 3:40 in the afternoon on Monday, April 8th, and I do that only because things change very rapidly. But now that I've said that, what was the first deadline, Craig?
Well, the first deadline was set for March 29th, 2019, which was exactly 2 years after Theresa May announced on March 29th, 2017, that the UK would be leaving the EU as of 2 years from that date. This was also sort of unofficially the launch of the election campaign for that year. But I know we'll get into that in a moment.
Yeah, we'll talk about the election in just a moment. As Anne has pointed out, Prime Minister Theresa May, was basically left with this to deal with, and it's been depicted in interesting ways in a variety of sources. Anne, would you like to comment on the two we have up here?
Yes and no. I think one thing that I found absolutely fascinating as I started putting together images of her is that she is invariably depicted wearing leopard print pumps. And that seems to be a consistent theme, and you see it's always high heel shoes, and they're always leopard print. Fascinating. But I think that in this case, right, I mean, you can see that and obviously, obviously political cartoons are not necessarily going to be known for their nuance, right? But at this point, I think it's very clear that in all depictions of the crisis and Theresa May, she's the only one kind of left dealing with this situation, right? All the other mm-hmm. players who helped contribute to the situation are not actually depicted in any of the images. It's Theresa May's problem to deal with, and hilarity ensues as we kind of imagine all the struggles she experiences.
Right, and in one of these, she is literally throwing a British bulldog into the water with a large metal ball that says Article 50, 29th of March. In the other one, she's seen trying to row England away from the EU, but Scotland's actually trying to row in the opposite direction. So it really does sort of set the stage that she is on her own here. Craig mentioned that there was an election held, and this was a decision made by Theresa May. Tell us a little bit about the election.
Well, Theresa May had a very narrow majority in House of Commons based on taking over from the Conservative Party's performance in 2015. And so she felt that she could increase her majority in Parliament by having an election in the spring of 2017, the idea being, because she knows the party is divided, she wanted to make sure that she had kind of a cushion there. And at first, the polls looked great. But it turns out that Theresa May was not a very good campaigner. And so what happened during the election is that the Conservatives lost their majority. They went from a slim majority to a slim minority government, and that leaves them dependent on a confidence and supply agreement, which is a very British politics idea for another party will help you get the votes across the line, make sure you don't get kicked out in a vote of no confidence or something like that, but we won't join the government and actually take responsibility for what's going on. Go back to that, theme again. And so what this left the Conservatives with is the reliance on a small, very socially conservative Northern Ireland party called the Democratic Unionist Party. Northern Ireland in that election was really interesting because virtually all the seats in Northern Ireland went to the Democratic Unionist Party, again, very conservative, pro-unionist party, and Sinn Féin, which is a strongly pro-Republican party, by which I mean wanting to unite Northern Ireland with the rest of Ireland, and Sinn Féin does not take their seats in Parliament. They, again, speaking of abrogation responsibility, Sinn Féin says, well, we're not going to take the oath to the Queen, so we're just not even going to show up. So essentially, all of the representation from Northern Ireland is effectively in the hands of the DUP. Again, this very conservative, pro-unionist, anti-EU party.
And we'll come back to that in just a moment, but I would like to discuss in a little more detail the issues that really need to be considered as part of this. You all have brought up trade, you've brought up immigration. There are other issues at play here, the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and then others, including what I wrote in my notes, the divorce payment or the alimony payment, because you don't get to just walk away. There will be a financial transaction when you leave the European Union. Tell us a little more about the transaction cost, so to speak, Jamie.
Yeah, so I'll talk about the divorce payment and also say a word about international trade. So the divorce payment. So, you know, this is an apt metaphor because after this very long relationship, these two entities have to really disentangle, and part of it is financial. And the estimate right now is that the divorce bill that Britain should owe would be somewhere on $40 billion. And the reason that Britain would owe money is that, first of all, it's responsible for its share of the EU budget until such time as it actually leaves. So at the moment, that would be through to 2020, given certain, you know, budgetary obligations, plus ongoing financial commitments to major projects that have already been approved by the EU. So that could extend, you know, for some years on end. And there are also other things, such as the not inconsequential issue of pension liabilities for sort of EU civil servants. So, and these are liabilities that are taken on when someone's hired by the European Union as a clerk or as a diplomat or whatever. And so whatever countries are in the union at that time are responsible for some fraction of that person's retirement plan. And so there are estimates that the EU could still be paying, you know, in 2060 or something for at least its last remaining share of its divorce bill. Of course, that divorce bill won't be finalized until an agreement is actually reached.
Then in terms of trade, Craig, you already mentioned several options here. What are some of the other trade possibilities?
Well, there are basically three models that they could adopt. They could go with the customs union model, which basically means that free trade of goods and services all throughout the EU plus the UK, but have an external tariff. They could go with a free trade agreement where it's lower tariffs, but they've negotiated the reduction of most tariffs between most of the countries. Or they could go for a Norway plus model, which sounds interesting. But Norway has a very close relationship with the EU, but they still have customs checks at the border. But they do allow workers to be based in the rest of Europe, but work in Norway and the other way around. There are variants beyond those three, but generally it's Customs Union Canada's type free trade agreement, which the EU just struck with Canada last year, and the Norway Plus model. Mm-hmm.
And obviously the border between North and South, which is a contentious border for many, many years, after things calmed down a little bit with free movement back and forth, people thought, okay, this is fine, but now that there's the potential to leave, what do you do? Do you put border actual fence back up? And that's a major issue, especially for those who live right along the border. I forget how many dozens of ways to cross, let alone just crossing over a field.
Several hundred.
I saw a reporter where a reporter was talking to a farmer whose dog just ran across, and he said, well, the dog's now in Northern Ireland, so I guess I can't go get my dog. You know, he's sort of joking that this is the level of concern that we have to deal with, but there's no way that this is considered as part of the issue here. Does anybody want to add anything else that we need to include? Jamie first and then Anne?
Yeah, so, you know, what many Brexiteers really, really want, they want to get out of the union, but one of the things they want most is for Britain to be able to strike its own trade deals with countries all around the world. And for that, you have to get out of the customs union, because the customs union is the agreement that says that all the members of the union have the exact same external trade rules with the entire outside world. And so if Britain stays within the customs union, it cannot negotiate separate agreements of its own with the United States or with Canada or with India or with anybody. And so to Brexiteers, that is just a red line. They are unwilling to cross that, most of them. And so this becomes a real problem. It's a problem in two ways. One, because in my personal opinion, I think it's based on a fairly naive view of the amount of power that Britain still has in the world. I totally understand why they would want that kind of freedom. Don't get me wrong. I'm not disagreeing with the desire to sort of control your own trade. Of course, a country would be very interested in that. But a lot of this rhetoric has been bolstered by this idea that Britain can effectively kind of recreate an empire in a way and can be the free trader to the rest of the world, and that countries will be clamoring to come and trade with Britain. And so far, countries have not at all been clamoring to come to trade with Britain. In fact, virtually every other country has said, we're not even going to talk to you about a trade agreement until you get this thing fixed and figure out how you're leaving the European Union. And Vote Leave had promised something like 42 trade agreements by the time Britain left, and there are zero because, of course, no one wants to do this with Britain. And the second really important thing was brought up by Andy, that the border on the island of Ireland that runs between the UK and Ireland. If you want to leave the customs union, then you have to have a border with the European Union. It just comes down to that, and everyone knew it from the beginning, but people who made the leave argument, I believe dishonestly, wanted to create the impression that somehow this could get worked out. But it's just really, really clear. If you want to leave a customs union, there's really no way around this.
I'm sorry, Craig.
I think that one of the things that may have taken some people in Britain by surprise is that if we think about kind of the four freedoms, the freedom of movement of people, of goods, of services, of capital, from the point of view of the EU, the four are bundled together, and that bundling is non-negotiable. And I think it took a lot of people in Britain by surprise that they thought they could pick and choose, right? Mm-hmm. This seems to be okay. Well, sure, we can do this, right? In particular, capital, I think, but certainly some of the other ones as well. And so I think the realization that this is all part of the same part of the package, and that the empire of glory, you know, is not going to be easily recreatable, I think was kind of quite a shock for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Now, back to this idea that Theresa May has sort of left here on her own. One of the editorial cartoons that Anne found is Theresa May sitting on a park bench. Mrs. May takes her dog Brexit out for a walk, and then some police officers, anything wrong with your dog, ma'am? There's nothing wrong with my dog, shut up. Which sort of presents her as this person who has one way of doing things, and she's going to ram that through. But it also is a sort of a metaphor for how alone she is. There are not a lot of people who are stepping up and saying, oh, I've got an idea. I know how we can do this. That's just not been the case. And you had another one that you wanted to point out to people. This one here?
I think that they're perfect. They illustrate perfectly the concerns that were raised by Jamie and Craig about the challenges of economics, right? I mean, that sort of this idea, we will put together a brand new, customs model, right? I mean, it's not something that can be, that can be done easily. And so I think, again, leaving aside this is the first one where she's not wearing leopard shoes, but I think it's an homage to the Sound of Music, so that she couldn't. But the criticism of, I certainly don't want to make it seem that I don't think that she's above criticism, right, or that she shouldn't be mocked, right? I mean, that's the job of political cartoonists and political satire. But I do think, she's a very interesting figure, right? Because again, when all the men who were advocating for this kind of stepped aside, here was Theresa May kind of left holding this, and I think it's very easy to criticize her, of course, right? But kind of whatever she's doing, she is the one responsible, and she's the one trying to find a solution, which just seems to be equivalent of her beating her head against the various walls, right? Mm-hmm. And the courage that it takes to mock her from other politicians, right? And the courage that it takes to say what you would have done if only you were still in a position of power, right? It's problematic, and I think this is particularly interesting because there's studies that show, right, that kind of this tends to happen, right? That you have women ending up in positions of power in moments of crisis, in part because the men are not interested because it looks like it's not going to be a promising way to advance one's career. And for women, this is the only, if you're interested in power, which politicians are, this is your chance, right? That in good times, you're not going to necessarily have an opportunity to get to this kind of power. And so she just makes for a very interesting figure in the discourse about her attempts to solve these mm-hmm. problems.
Yeah.
Is a very strongly gendered one and a very interesting
Jamie.
One.
So I think I'd like to push back a bit against this. I certainly agree that it is often the case that, we see men sort of leaving women to clean up the mess in politics. I think that's true. However, she was not some powerless victim of all this. She fought very, very hard for the prime ministership. When David Cameron was ousted, there was a big, big battle, and all of her opponents were men, and they fought like tooth and nail to get where she is today. She won it because she won that fair and square. People were fighting for it. People really, really wanted to be prime minister. And then when she called a snap election the following year, she showed that she was very, very ineffective in actually winning an election. And I would say most analysts agree that the main liability of the Conservative Party was her very poor style of campaigning. And now I think when we look back on things, I think now what we see are men saying, and not just men, but everybody else saying, I refuse to become prime minister until she finishes the job, and then I'll take over and not have to worry about that. But I think that there are all sorts of ways in which we can very, very clearly criticize Theresa May for not competently handling especially as we get closer and closer to these March and April deadlines, not competently handling the challenge that she faced.
Yeah, I think Anne's comment actually reminds me of that infamous Onion headline right after the 2008 election in the United States where Barack Obama wins, and the headline was something like, "Black man given world's worst job." Because the economy was in such a mess at that point that, Americans were willing to elect, Barack Obama as president in sort of the same way that Theresa May became prime minister.
My point was not to suggest that she's a victim. I think I certainly want to give her all the agency she deserves for being a politician who wanted power. But I think to suggest that the conservatives lost because she's a bad campaigner, maybe conservatives lost because they had a crappy message. It is possible.
She was a very bad campaigner. There are all sorts of examples of that.
If the majority right now are interested in staying, it's possible that people didn't want to vote, not because of four conservatives, not because she was a crappy campaigner. She may very well have been. But it's also possible that mm-hmm. there was no man, no matter how good of a campaigner he was, that could have sold the message that was genuinely not popular, right, based on the current mm-hmm. polls that show that the majority mm-hmm. is interested in staying rather than in leaving.
But one of the interesting issues here is that the polling shows there's still not a wide margin. It's
right.
not like
no.
there's been
no,
some
there's
massive
a wider
no.
than before. There's wider a, than before.
Wider than before, but still so close that for a lot of people, cautious folks don't necessarily want to step into that because it is. It is a colossal mess at the moment, and we probably should, in the interest of time, jump to what sort of options have been discussed. On April 1st, there were in a way that we would never see happening in the United States. There were seven different votes before Parliament on different ways to approach this, and every single one of them failed. Political scientists, I'll come to historian in a second, but as political scientists, what does it say to you when you see a parliament, a legislative body with sovereignty, looking at seven options and not picking any of them?
If you look at the breakdown of the parties who are voting in not only these advisory votes, but in the ones a few days later, it tells me that there are a bunch of parties that are keeping their powder dry. Because there are a lot of parties that a lot of people didn't vote at all. The S&P basically stayed out of a number of these votes. And of course, the cabinet was ordered to not vote. And so we still, even after all of this, we still really don't have an idea of what the majority would in fact accept. I mean, the permanent customs union, that seems to be the best choice. I mean, it's got the smallest margin, not only in this vote, but on the one a few days after that. And again, with a second place going to having a second referendum on whatever the results is, which is not, you know, that's not an answer, that's just a process. So I guess customs union is still the best possibility. But until everyone's willing to put their cards on the table, we're just not going to know.
Interestingly, when the number of options was reduced a couple of days later, we did get closer to majorities. But Jamie, any comments on April Fool's Day
out? I would just say that, I mean, what this shows is a country that's just divided down the middle. And you know, it raises the question of whether any country should be making so dramatic a decision about its future when there is simply no consensus about what should happen next.
And even though we're talking about a parliamentary structure, which normally means good party cohesion, as Craig pointed out, the election costs the Conservatives their majority, and when you have a coalition government, you can't really count on keeping that majority with you, especially on something this contentious, given where that minority part of the coalition government is coming from.
Yeah,
just makes no sense.
The Conservatives at this point are maybe 25%, you know, Remainers, and maybe 50% hardcore, let's just get out of here right now, Leavers, and then that leaves that 25% kind of mushy in between, like, where do they go? Mm-hmm. And we don't have an answer for that.
I'm sorry. And this is an excellent point that Craig's making, and most of the parties are internally divided over Brexit.
Yep.
Not all of them. The DUP, not so
much. S&P, not so much. But right. Labor, certainly.
But, so the two biggest parties by far, Labor and the Conservatives, are both deeply divided in among themselves. Yep. And so this makes it even more complicated because you can't just say, well, at least, you know, we have effectively a minority government of the Tories with help from the DUP, and they can't just push through something they want even if others don't want it because a significant minority of their own base doesn't want it. And then the Labourites who there are some in Labour want to leave, but they're very wary of handing the Conservatives a victory. And so you can imagine all the different sort of complications that ensue when the two largest parties in the country are both internally divided over Brexit, even as they try to hold on to their own sort of basis of power, just in a general sense.
It doesn't help that the leader of Labour can't make up his mind about what to do.
Right. So Britain is plagued by terrible leadership of both major parties. Theresa May is a terribly ineffective leader, and Jeremy Corbyn,
a close second.
He's a very different kind of leader with very different kinds of faults, but I would say as deeply flawed as she.
Anne? No. Okay. One of the things that's been discussed, of course, is to have a second referendum. That's come up repeatedly. There was a small protest took place in March of earlier this year with an awful lot of people showing up. You can see a couple of photos from that. The referendum's not likely to happen. In part, it would be a recommendation again. And what would be on the ballot? Well, there we go. Silence and some shoulder shrugs lets us know that we're not sure what would happen there.
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem. So with any referendum, there's the question of how to word it. And, of course, how you word the referendum is very important, perhaps, in sort of, you know, skewing the results that come out the other end. But, I mean, you know, for a referendum on something this important, for example, you probably only want two options because you want there at least to be a majority in the end. It's unlike in a country of 60 million, you have an actual tie. So you would the moment you throw in a third option, and many people have talked about putting three different options on or so, then it becomes very hard for any one option to get over 50%, and then even the winning option will have a lot less legitimacy. And so just thinking about what would go in there is one issue. The other issue, of course, is that most people who voted to leave believe that the holding of a second referendum is illegitimate because the country already held one, and you shouldn't be able to come back several years later and just see if you've changed your mind. And but we can talk more about that.
Yeah. Well, and I think that I'm glad that you, since you mentioned the question of legitimacy, I think one of the interesting things that we haven't really had a chance to talk about is the question of sort of the circumstance, kind of going back to the question of how legitimate was the referendum, right? Because I think that certainly since the referendum took place, we've increasingly had more and more information about, first of all, questions about who funded some of the unofficial campaigns, and a lot of questions about whether that money was potentially coming from Russia in huge volumes. And of course, the kind of the disinformation campaign through social media, also not just funded by Russia, but essentially run out of a factory, you know, in St. Petersburg, some of the same company that played an important role in the U.S. presidential election as well. And so I think it's not necessarily going to be, it's obviously not going to be an effective argument, oh, that one was illegitimate and therefore we should do it. Although, interestingly enough, right, I think one of the, when we talk about democracies and advanced democracies, mature democracies, right, it doesn't seem like that they have a built-in option for a do-over, right? It's interesting that when we look at countries in other parts of the world, right, where they have, if they have an election that's deemed by the West to be illegitimate, let's say there was corruption, let's say there were, you know, for example, right, there's often the assumption that, oh, well, of course they're going to declare the election invalid, and of course they're going to have a do-over and do it right. That does not seem to be a possibility in the advanced democracies, even if there's increasingly more and more information about, you know, potential kind of questions about legitimacy. And certainly when we think about who wins from all of this, right, I think Russia is definitely going to be at the top of the list of countries that are going to benefit tremendously from this, right? Both if we think about broader discord in the West, check, right? Weakening of the EU, check, both economically and militarily, right? Britain, I mean, again, we can make fun of Britain as a waning, as a power in the wane, but, you know, there's still an important military power, and losing that from the EU, I think, is, you know, is potentially significant. The other important thing, kind of, if we're thinking about economically, right, the part of what allowed Russia to be able to do to funnel so much money into it, right, is the lack of transparency when it comes to financial institutions. The EU, again, for all the weaknesses of the EU is probably the only body, certainly in Europe, possibly the world, that would be in the position to try to make financial transactions more transparent, right? And so the Britain leaving the EU and the EU being weakened definitely benefits Russia and many and other countries as well, right? But certainly Russia when it comes to funneling money, ill-gotten money, perhaps, illegally gotten money, and funneling that into, you know, whether for economic benefit or for political destabilization, which has been kind of a major hallmark of contemporary Russia, kind of the, you know, the contrast between the Cold War, where the Soviet Union thought that they could win by presenting kind of a perfect alternative, right, versus the current model. Let's just destabilize the hell out of the West, right? We don't need to present an alternative. We just need to weaken significantly and destabilize and kind of undermine legitimacies of democracies, democratic institutions, and so on. And that's already going to be a huge win for Russia.
I mean, you would need clear and convincing evidence that there was massive fraud in an election and an advanced socialist democracy in order for them to redo it. So like the situation in North Carolina. Yeah. Right now, that's a good example.
But it's just small. But on a smaller scale. But I'm so glad you mentioned that. You're right.
But it's incredibly rare that something like that happens.
Right.
Now we find ourselves once again, April 8th, in the afternoon, waiting to see what happens. We could have held this before March 29th. That you know we might have been wrong then. We could be wrong now. There are several deadlines that have come and passed in many respects. We do know that the EU is planning on meeting on April 10th, where they will consider a request from the UK to extend this until June 30th, which a lot of people are not happy about. But in the end, we get graphics like the one, for those of you in the room, can see that present sort of these wonderful flowcharts of if-this-then scenarios, which are sort of hilarious to look at, except for when you think about the significance of what's going on. So there are a couple of things very quickly. The EU could refuse an extension, in which case England will leave with no deal on April 12th. And there actually are people who are perfectly happy with that, who would actually prefer that, because then they can immediately go to work on several other issues. if there's an extension, then many, many things could happen. But I'm going to do something that we all hate, but I'm going to do it to you all anyway. Jamie's shaking his head at me already. What do you think is going to happen? And I am going to make Jamie go first.
Mm-hmm. Well, my answer is that a lot of things might happen. Because Andy put me in the position that no political scientist ever wants to be in, which is to predict an unknowable future. I will say a few things. This is really, of course, endlessly fascinating, and we talk about this in the hallways of our department all the time because it's just one of the most interesting and complex issues that we've ever seen come along in politics. So I don't know what will happen, and I'm not going to try to predict, but I will say a few things. Theresa May is going to, all right, this is a prediction. Theresa May is going to go back to the EU to ask for this extension. That's my only prediction, because I'm pretty sure it's going to happen. And, you know, the real issue is what happens then on the EU side. I want to make the following point. One of the most remarkable and underrated things about this entire thing is the unity of the other 27 member states of the European Union. When this whole business started, there were a lot of people who said, uh-oh, this move by Britain to leave the European Union is really going to shake the union because there are going to be all sorts of disagreements within the EU 27, the other 27, about how to handle Britain's departure. And this is going to show that the European Union is a lot more fragile than we thought, and it's really riven by conflicts of national interest. It's astonishing how unified the EU 27 have remained, especially given their tremendous political differences on all sorts of other things. Now, who knows? This could start breaking soon. And there are some suggestions that, you know, there may be some divisions coming up in the next few days. But regardless of what happens, it's incredible that it's happened, that unity has remained so far. And it speaks to the tremendous strength of the European Union. And it has made Britain's departure more challenging than Britain expected it to be.
Craig?
Well, in part, that's because the UK has very few friends in the EU. And they have made it clear that they don't want friends in the EU. I mean, looking back to one of the editorial cartoons we were showing before, Theresa May is being drawn to look a lot like Maggie Thatcher, and I'm sure that's deliberate because Thatcher had a very contentious relationship with the European Community when she was Prime Minister. So this has deep roots. This, you know, divide between the UK and the rest of the EU. In terms of predictions, man, I almost tell my students we have Eliza crystal balls, but I'm going to do it anyway. My guess is that at the special summit on the 10th, that the EU will approve another short extension, probably out to May 22nd, the first day of the European parliamentary elections. And at that point, it will be a you are out or you are in. This is the end of the road. We're not gonna let this extend any further because Theresa May is not going to accept a year-long extension, so out to, let's say, you know, June of 2020. And the EU is not going to accept that June 30th deadline because that would obligate the UK to vote for European Parliament members who would never sit in the European Parliament, and that would just be weird. It would completely foul up the European Parliament for the next 5 years because those seats will just be empty. And nobody wants that. Nobody wants that to happen. The elections are going to be contentious enough anyway. There are probably going to be a huge increase in the number of populist and nationalist parties that get into the European Parliament. So they're going to have that problem. They're going to have that problem already. They simply don't want to have 72, I think it is, empty European parliamentary seats for the next 5 years.
Yeah, we should remember those seats will actually get reallocated.
Most
of them will get
some
reallocated.
Some of them will get reallocated. Yeah. Some of them will just disappear into the ether.
Anne?
I do have a prediction, but I wanted to follow up very quickly on one of Jamie's points about the unity of the 27. I think one of the things that is so interesting, right, is that one of the more recent developments, right, is representatives from the Conservative Party trying to lobby some of the right-wing governments in Europe to veto the proceedings, right? And so it's telling that these are the alliances that these people form, right? While they drape themselves in the mantle of patriotism and how this is all about Britain being on its own, they're not interested in you having their fate in their hands. They want right-wing dictatorships to have the fate of Britain in their hands, which is just, I mean, an interesting way of expressing one's patriotism. But my prediction is going to be that Britain is going to eventually leave, and it's going to to leave as a diminished country, and Britain is going, and there's going to be kind of a, you know, much for decades there will be hand-wringing about all the loss. The empire that will never be recaptured, the lost glory that will never be recaptured, all of the sort of the nostalgia about the past magnified because everything is going to be constantly a constant reminder of Britain of lost status, whether it's going to be shortages of toilet paper or insulin, you know, or loss of the opportunities in the financial sector that are going to hit Britain really hard, both in terms of loss of jobs, but also revenue from taxes, which means they're going to have to increase taxes to make up for that loss. I mean, there's just going to be kind of this every day is going to bring some reminder of the consequences of that particular decision. And that's what they're going to have to live with. And if they ever decide to come back, they're going to have to lose the pound. So, yeah, you know, it's just... It's going to be just this long reminder. Everything will remind them.
That was exactly what I was going to say, is that there's a very easy solution to all those problems. Rejoin the EU.
Or just don't leave.
Right.
Or just which they could still do.
Which they could still do.
In fact, it takes no vote by the EU Council. Britain could simply say, we're back in, cancel Article 50, and end of story.
And if Britain were to rejoin at some future day, it would never be able to join on the incredibly favorable terms that its current membership has. And we didn't even talk about that, and that's fine. But I would just point out that Britain, over time, has negotiated some very valuable opt-outs and benefits that other countries don't have. And so even as it's trying to get out, it's trying to get out of the best deal that anybody's ever gotten out of the European Union. And that will never be given to Britain again if it ever wants to come back.
Anybody have any questions?
Yeah, I have a question about the decision to hold the referendum, because one of the things I was thinking about is something that you've talked about in class, Professor Ortsy, is the democratic deficit and how that's a criticism of the EU, how it's too removed from the people themselves. So is the referendum, was that like a symbolic measure to really like show that this is what the people want?
Absolutely. I mean, the hope was from Cameron's point of view that a majority of Britons would say, yes, we want to remain in the European Union. That would shut up his Eurosceptic wing. See, the people voted and they said, no, we want to stay here. We now, and he could go back to the EU and say, look, the majority of my people actually support us remaining in here. We have solved our democratic deficit problem by holding this one vote. And that is not at all what happened.
Jamie?
Effectively, in my view, what David Cameron did in launching the referendum was try to repair a problem that his own party had created within his own party over the past two decades. So the Conservative Party, for the better part of two decades, had been trashing the European Union for electoral benefits within Britain. And so, and this was really driving a divide within the Conservative Party. And Cameron, I believe through hubris, decided that he was talented enough to engineer a referendum that he would win, that would keep Britain in the EU and would finally shut up the Eurosceptics within the Conservative Party that had kind of ripped the party apart. And in the end, he was unable to do that, and in my view at least, damaged the country. But he certainly didn't fix his own party within his own problem within the party. And again, that problem was self-inflicted by conservatives.
I would like to point out that Cameron has actually offered advice about a second referendum, to which several people have said, I don't think David Cameron's the person to give advice about referenda.
No kidding.
We have a question over here and then to the back.
It's kind of an open question, but would you consider Brexit being an outlier for the reach of Euroscepticism, or do you kind of see it as like the future of other countries, like, for example, the alternative for Deutschland and that kind of stuff? Yeah.
Jamie? Wow, that's very interesting, because obviously there are a lot of common features, right? There's Euroscepticism throughout the continent in a number of different countries, varies tremendously from country to country. So in that respect, there are a number of similarities. On the other hand, there's some ways in which Britain is special. And I mean, Anne mentioned earlier that kind of long historic strange relationship that Britain has had with the continent, you know, that the English Channel is not only a physical divide, but a psychological divide. This question of whether we're a part of Europe or apart from Europe is so fundamental. So what I think is noteworthy now is that it's quite astonishing, I think, that even given all the Euroscepticism in many countries in Europe, the EU27 are still holding together. But I could easily see that, you know, fraying over time. But my guess is it'll happen in a somewhat different way that it happened in Britain, because Britain has a certain degree of uniqueness on this. But it's a really good question.
Anne?
I think, well, the specific the specific party you mentioned for Germany, right, Alternative to for Deutschland, it's one of the many right-wing political parties in Europe funded by Russia. And so I think one of the, so I mean, I, obviously as a Russian historian, I'm going to keep coming back to that. But I do think that they are, that Russia act as a major spoiler, right? They are funding, I mean, they're indiscriminate, I mean, as far as which political, whether it's on the right or on the left, but primarily at this particular moment, right, they're primarily funding parties on the right, including extreme right, because they see them as the, they see these parties as the best investment to destabilize their countries. So I think the answer to for me, right, the answer to your question really largely lies with how seriously will Europeans finally start taking this threat, right? And Russia capitalizes on the fact that officially the Cold War is over, mm-hmm. and looking for spies everywhere is so passé, and blaming Russia for everything is so passé, right? I mean, and so they're really capitalizing on that, and they are acting more and more brazenly all the time, right? And unless that's checked in some way, and not, you know, by actually enforcing laws that these countries already have about foreigners, you know, paying for, funding elections. If that doesn't happen, then this could continue to spread, right? But if the European governments actually take the Russian threat seriously, there's a phrase I literally never thought 10 years ago, I would have never thought I would ever utter that phrase. Then I think that I think this will be a warning to the rest of Europe much more than a prediction for the European future.
I mean, I think it's a unique set of circumstances in the UK where you had a combination of a large, essentially Eurosceptical party and a country that could afford to bail on the EU, again, because of the very twisted special relationship that they have with the EU. Absent both of those things, I don't see any of the other countries bailing. Even though you have, again, a Eurosceptical government in charge in Italy, you've got a Eurosceptical government in charge of Hungary and Poland, none of those countries could afford to push the eject button on the EU, because they would find themselves out in the wilderness, beyond the pale economically, and they would never recover from that. The UK, they can recover from this. It's a more than $1 trillion economy. They could do it. But the other countries, I think they'd have a very hard time doing that.
Yeah, and that word afford is so important. Just a quick note, which is that in many of the most Eurosceptical countries also get much more in financial aid effectively from the European Union than they pay in. So a government like Viktor Orban's in Hungary constantly argues against the EU and complains about the EU and is very happy to take in huge amounts of money to build highways and airports and this kind of stuff.
Yeah, Nigel Farage on a countrywide level.
Yeah, so they don't want to leave. At least right now, not right now.
One more question.
All right. Thanks, you guys. This is a really great panel. I'm curious about the political situation now in the UK. I mean, you talked about that intergenerational split, right? We've got younger people who want to remain, older people who want to leave. Do you see any kind of realignment with political parties kind of being led by the young and kind of shaping what the political party system will look like in the UK? How impactful has this kind of whole issue of Brexit been on, and could it reshape what the political situation is going to look like?
If there were ever to be a realignment of British politics anytime soon, this would be the moment, because of how incredibly deep, how deeply people are feeling about this. I mean, the language of British politics right now has gotten so stark. I mean, I've followed British politics for years. I lived in Britain for a while. I've never seen it like this, with people talking about treason and this sort of stuff. It's just alien to sort of their sort of British political discourse. And so I think what we also saw is once the referendum vote took place and Theresa May became prime minister, and by the way, Theresa May was a Remainer when she took the prime ministership, and then committed to taking Britain out because that was her sort of obligation. Ever since then, there has been no party that took it upon itself to be the pro-European party. Well, they're the Liberal Democrats, who've always been most pro-European, but their support has collapsed in recent years for reasons only partly related to this. And this is, I think we mentioned this before, this is Labour's huge, in my opinion, lost opportunity. It could have reframed itself as a pro-European party. Yes, it would have lost a lot of its votes, but it would have gained others. And so now what we've seen over the past 2 years is that people who wanted to stay are utterly demoralized, and there has been no one to champion them. So, even though this, if there's no better time for a realignment in Britain than now, I'm not sure that there's anyone who's really willing to sort of try to shape that. Certainly not Jeremy Corbyn, who's the leader of the Labour Party, who's been a tremendous disappointment to people who wanted to stay.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental problem with having a realignment in the UK is the electoral system, because it's first past the post.
Like ours.
I mean, exactly like the United States is. And so it's very unlikely that the Lib Dems could ever become a strong enough party to displace Labour or the Conservatives in a system like that. And again, it doesn't help that you've got someone who is deeply, deeply ambivalent about the European Union and capitalism and all the rest of it in charge of the Labour Party.
Well, I want to thank the panelists James Toole and Craig Ordsey from the Department of Political Science and Liv Schiz from the Department of History. Thank you all very much for joining us. Once again, this was brought to you by the Departments of Political Science and History at PFW. College TV was kind enough to capture all of this for us and make it available not only on College TV, but also their YouTube channel and through WBOI. And thank you very much for joining us.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Special thanks to College TV for providing the audio for this program. Our theme music is by Mark Waldick and Noah Campodonico. Our WBOI intern is Brandon Williams. Until next time, thank you for listening.